You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation, brought to you by Go Wild. Now, as we all know, Go Wild is one of the fastest growing and most popular social media apps, specifically for outdoorsmen, hunting, fishing, and so forth and so on. But recently, they have announced a partnership with Garmin Connect IQ app. Now, what this does, this is like an integration between both platforms. The Go Wild community members will have the ability to track and share robust digital stories ranging from automated archery shot counts, miles hiked, you know, whatever you do throughout the hunt, like scout, put up your tree stand. And this is the cool thing, biometric data collecting. Now, what that is let's say it's your heart rate. And it will track your heart rate, everything from when you see the big buck, as the big buck gets closer and closer, your heart rate starts to go up, you draw back, you shoot the deer, and then the deer runs away. And the app records all that, and you're able to see what your heart rate is throughout this entire process. And I think that's really cool, along with all the other benefits and features of Go Wild, like tracking and documenting your hunt. So go to the website, timetogowild.com, or you can download the Go Wild app wherever you download your apps. So get outside. It's time to go wild.
When it comes to the essentials of a hunt, a consulting trip, or our real estate business, a map is always a key component of it. And a high-quality map is a must.
We don't dare step on a property for any of those activities without looking and understanding property boundaries, terrain, you know, what the habitat may be like. Try and get a full understanding of the property. HuntTerra maps are that quality we're looking for, whether it be their Magna map, poster map, field map, mobile map. They've got it all for any situation.
And topo overlay. They even have acre grid patterns on it, so you can look at a food plot and get a pretty doggone good idea of just how big it is with the acreage overlay. A lot of great tools, and you should definitely check them out at HuntTerra.com.
All right, we're going to jump right into this Habitat Heroes podcast. We have a special guest with us, but we have one announcement to make before we jump into that podcast.
Which precludes this guest, really. I mean, it's a cool announcement. We're certainly looking forward to having the opportunity to interact with you guys, and we're going to do that by having an event called After Hours with Land and Legacy at the NWTF convention February 16th, which is the Saturday evening after the show closes. We have a room, and this event is sponsored by Pure Air Natives. But it'll be at 6 o'clock, Bayou Room C. Meet us there. We're going to have everything's free seminar, but a seminar we've never done before. I don't think we even know really the topic yet. We're just going to leave it open.
Well, we know the topic. We just don't know how it's all going to flow. So
yeah,
you guys kind of have an idea of, well, you have an idea of how we manage and do all this. But this one, since we're at NWTF,
yes,
it's in February. It's not going to be as focused on... So you may think that some of our seminars are built around how to kill a big buck, but this one's more on native habitat and overall habitat improvement and landscape architecture, all that stuff that we talk about on the podcast.
A tentative name, Ruling the Roost with Native Species.
Yeah, that's...
There we go.
Yep.
But we'll tie it all in. Natives, turkeys, everything you could think of. Being a great presentation.
I believe we're going to have food there.
Yep. And then there will be a live Q&A afterwards that we're going to record for a podcast. So
yes,
definitely have an opportunity to interact, get everyone on the podcast who's got questions. So if you are attending the event or are considering attending...
Even if you're in the area.
Yeah. Stop by. And did we say this is the Gaylord? This is the Gaylord Opryland Hotel. So right there where the NWTF convention is being held... Find where Bayou Room C is, and we'll be there 6 o'clock Saturday evening, February 16th.
The end of the show. We're going to be going in there and having it. And I mean, we don't really have a time for. I think they gave us a room from 6 to 10. So
6 to 11.
6 to 11. So we can be in there for as long as you guys really want until you're just sick of us. Until you're so sick of Native Habitat that you're ready to go home or go back to the hotel room. So come join us. We are going to have some giveaways. Yep. We're going to basically, it's just a great time to hang out and talk.
Hang out, talk, chat. Number two, there will be a Facebook event as well for this.
Yeah.
So we'd encourage you and ask you if you're interested and are definitely coming to go onto the Facebook page, Land Legacy, and click yes, interested, or coming to the event. So we just have a heads up of the number of people who are going to be there. But we're certainly looking forward to it. Kind of long overdue of doing a kind of an event like this for people who are listening. But we're going to be there. Hopefully a lot of you all will be there as well. We'd love to interact with you.
And one more thing.
Oh, okay.
Check out our Facebook group.
Oh, yes.
Don't overlook. You know, there's a lot of Facebook groups on Facebook, obviously.
That's convenient.
Yeah, there's a lot of groups on Facebook that are kind of talk land management, different stuff. But we created one to where basically we want to, we've got a lot of, we're building a list of credible contributors to
and
administrators to where we can kind of keep it to a very land habitat, native habitat, conservation-minded Facebook group.
And
so it's very much a focused in on things that people are doing across the country to improve their land. So go check it out. It's called, you can find it through our Facebook page, Land and Legacy, and then go to groups, or you can just search on Facebook, Land, Wildlife, and Conservation Community.
Absolutely. It'll be a great place because of the setup to get really credible information and learn about different techniques people are using across the country. We're gonna have people in kind of strategic locations to be adding their two cents into this group. So we encourage you to join the group, become a part of it. We're gonna be sharing posts and stuff in there as well, of course. So hopefully you guys will check out the event on the Facebook page, the new group, and then join us February 16th, 6 o'clock, Bayou Room C, Gaylord Opryland Hotel, for our after-hours seminar and social.
All right, welcome to Land and Lakes Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
And we have another Habitat. Is it? Are we going to make this Habitat Heroes Podcast?
I think we ought to.
And so it's...
Obviously, we have this thing so planned out.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have... returning guest from months ago, but you'll hear why we're meeting up here. This is exciting times. If you guys haven't heard, we're right in the heat of planting season.
That's right.
We are hardcore planting, and you guys should be too. And you're now wondering, looking at your thing, going, "Is this an old podcast, new podcast? Like what?
No. This is January.
Why are they talking about planting season? It's January. You guys are crazy.
Yes,
but
we
have returning guest. Justin Adams from Pure Air Natives.
I forgot my name there for a
second.
Well,
you know what's funny? I know your name. I know your first name for sure. But I have to always think about it because I've got Justin Lawson from QDMA.
We've got
Justin Adams here. I got another friend that's Justin Adams. And so I'm like always trying to like between you and Justin Lawson, because I talk to you guys and it's like, wait, no, which Cutie May, Pure NAs, Pure? Okay, I got
them
sorted
out. And we've got a Justin over at Stratton Seed, too.
That's right.
So
that's right.
There's Justins all around you.
That's right.
That's a sign of success.
That, for sure.
Some would say.
Well, today we had three mats involved.
That was tough.
That was a project.
So I guess to give a little bit of an explanation, we are here. Justin Adams from Pure Air Natives is here with a couple other guys from Pure Air Natives. We are in Webster County, Missouri, at a landowner's property, Matt Miles, who's a outdoor photographer and kind of a nature photographer. So
landscape scenes, wildlife of all shapes and sizes. Very knowledgeable of the native habitat, too. Does an awesome job at documenting landscape scenes really across the country, but has recently focused right here in the Show Me State in Missouri.
That's right. And this is actually his home property, or going to be his home property. And he is working with you guys at Pure Air Natives to plant a 6-acre field, mainly, I guess, predominantly the pollinator blend, correct?
Predominantly is the Monarch pollinator blend, yes. So he's actually involved with the NRCS program called EQIP, and they've got a 6-acre Monarch-specific habitat that we're planting today, as well as 2 acres of warm season grasses.
That's right. And so it's kind of an interesting spot. It's right up next to the highway, but kind of a north-facing slope. And this is what's so exciting and cool to me. So this is going to be his home site, but this property and this specific field was kind of old field fescue pasture. Of course, as an outdoor photographer, avid hunter, and just a naturalist, I guess, if he wants to be called that, he wanted to see it go back into a kind of a native type, more scenic, more aesthetic, but also, most importantly, more pleasing to the wildlife and land. And so right now we have this huge push, and Justin, I'll ask you to talk about this a little bit, but there's this kind of huge push for the pollinator species, specifically for the monarch butterfly. And why is that?
Well, there's talk of the monarch butterfly being put on the endangered species list. And the main reason for that is loss of habitat, right?
So yeah.
Monarch butterflies migrate from deep in Mexico, maybe even further south than that. I'm not 100% sure, but all the way through the United States and up into Canada. So it's a very big migration pattern. And part of the monarch butterfly's survival is the species of milkweed. There's several different varieties of milkweed. There's butterfly, there's common, there's swamp, there's world. There's several different kinds of milkweed. So the monarch butterfly needs that species in order to survive. So what the government has done with these USDA NRCS programs is come in and said, we want to establish more monarch habitat in the migration zone. So that for Missouri is the western side of Missouri. And you can come in and install some of these species into your prairie, and it's going to provide that habitat. And more importantly, it's going to provide the habitat at the right time. That's very important because the monarch butterfly is only migrating through at a certain time. And if your species are not are not in bloom at that time, then it doesn't do the monarch butterfly any good. So
that's right.
That's what these programs are, very specific and detailed to that. And on top of the milkweed species that are in the pollinator blend as well, there are 20 other species of native forbs and wildflowers that are going to provide, for the pollinators, bees, birds, butterflies.
That's correct. Yeah, and a little bit of grass mixed in. With this slope, I think the grass is kind of to help establish and get established earlier to where it benefits the flowers, the pollinators in the long run.
Sure.
Yeah. At what percentage have you guys seen change in the last few years with this emphasis on pollinators? Like, I know deer hunters, everybody wants to plant native grasses, but have you seen a big change? And I know you've only been at Pure Air Natives a few years, but are you seeing a more because of the increase in chances for these government programs? Are you guys actually seeing the seed going in the ground?
You know, we are, and I would say probably if you're looking for one, specific mix that's probably beneficial to all the species out there, from small mammals to large mammals and game species here in Missouri, birds, butterflies, bees, pollinators, insects, everything from the soil up, it's going to be the monarch blend or it's going to be the pollinator blend. And the more research that goes into that, the more benefits that are found through healthier soil, through cleaner water, cleaner air. All those things come from a diverse species, a diverse mix like this that gets planted in the ground. So you're starting to see programs utilize this for a lot of different solutions to better the environment, the habitat that you're doing. So you'll get a lot of cattle ranchers who have a 1/2 acre and they want to plant pollinator mix. You'll get a lot of upland game bird hunters that want to plant pollinator mixes. You'll get even deer hunters and turkey hunters, because the bedding cover that it provides, the security, the browse that it provides for the whitetail. So you're going to get a very large swath of people that want to plant pollinator and monarch mixes because it is so beneficial, and that's definitely been on the rise.
For sure. At what acreage, with some of the other government programs, you kind of get prioritized, you get kind of put in a list where the amount of acreage that is available or that you're willing to increase and actually put into that program. And so, like, guys that are like, oh, I have an acre or whatever, sometimes they don't qualify for these big programs because, frankly, they're lower on the list of people that are going to make a bigger impact. Is there more people, since the pollinators, they're trying to get as many acres as possible, is there a chance for a guy who's, let's say, he's got an acre to qualify for the pollinator?
No, that's a great question, and the simple answer is yes. So every county, every USDA Soil Center has, you know, they're responsible for trying to put together programs for their county, and every county is slightly different. Some of the funds available for different programs, they pay out different in certain areas, right? But nobody at these organizations, they don't want a 300-acre field of pollinators or monarch species. They want to break up the habitat. So there's a lot of people that qualify and they're getting contracts for 1 acre or even half an acre, yeah, you know, 1.5 acres. So there's a lot of different habitats, you know, polka dotted throughout the state and a lot of other states, I'm sure, as well. So, you don't have to have a large piece of property to qualify and be awarded a contract.
And I think that's where a lot of guys could be like, man, I only have a half acre or full acre or whatever, and I want to make it more beneficial to my deer. And so they're like, call up, or are there any programs to improve my deer habitat? And it's like, well, you know, you can do a pollinator mix, probably better qualify or a better chance at qualifying, and it still benefits your deer. But you're just because it's called pollinator, some of us may say, ah, I'm not really worried about the flowers.
It's super easy to overlook all
that
stuff.
Oh, you are still back there.
I'm back here. We're it's cold today, and we're on site, and we're all snuggled up in a pickup truck, and I'm in the back seat. Left
we're
alone
not snuggled up. We're sitting in the driver's seat with the center console in between the passenger seats. So.
Just to clarify, people probably got a weird image right
you know,
there.
See, yeah.
Well, last week he said something like silly or something like that, and I'm like, man, people are going to start thinking we're weird.
You know what? We'll have to take a selfie and put it in the show notes so that everybody can see the plenty of space.
Everyone has their own their own space.
Silly last week, snuggled this week.
Yep.
Next week. Yeah. I can only imagine. Go ahead, Matt.
Just wait. Yeah, it's going to be wild next week.
Get to your point. No, go to it.
The point is, we got to think outside the box sometimes when we're talking programs and talking long-term goals. You know, we like to look at things differently, you know, from a consulting standpoint of, okay, let's offer something that the greater habitat outside of your property doesn't offer. And then we're able to see limited resources and add those to properties. And same thing goes for these pollinator mixes is, right, you know, you might be a turkey guy or a deer guy, but you think pollinator, what does that have to do or tie in? But it is a humongous benefit, and we just have to look at the long-term goals of what properties may be needing, lacking. And truthfully, pollinator blends fill a ton of voids in a yearly system.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to find a program that says, you know, here we're going to sponsor and put together you know, some funds for you to go out and put in a food plot. You know, they're not specific to that. They're much more broad, and they want a better ecological impact than putting in a food plot or putting in something like that. So yes, there's programs that are going to benefit whitetails and turkeys. They don't necessarily call them that because you're looking for something like a pollinator mix is going to benefit everything across the board. There's no missing check marks in that when you're looking for something. Whereas a food plot isn't beneficial for everything, you know, from the bottom up. There's holes in that in several places. So, you know, when we're talking about increasing habitat and being beneficial, you got to look at every species, not just, you know, the one that you're out hunting.
And it's you look at the programs and they're set, their goal, the big long-term goal for them is to improve soil, water, and air quality. That's why you have these programs that are delicate.
And wildlife.
Yeah.
Sure.
But, you know, it's not just so specific as food plot.
So let's look at today and say, okay, we've got 6 acres that was once fescue pasture. So really only provided benefit to the cattle. It wasn't a whole lot of benefit for much else, especially in native species and game species. So we're converting it from what was very, very little benefit to now we have this high diversity. How many species are we talking in this whole 6 acres?
An entire mix is 23.
23 species. Yes. So we have a long list, but when we look at the benefits, and I'll probably forget some because the list is long, but let's start in the soil. We're getting deeper rooted plants and high diversity of root, basically root makeup. So we're improving the soil structure and improving soil health because we have this diversity, which brings in a diversity of microbes. Plus they're going deeper. So these are more adaptive for drought, and they're much better for water infiltration. So we take that from it's improving the soil, but then also we're looking at improving the water quality in this area.
Which, and real quick to stop you there, is very beneficial for this site-specific property, too, mm-hmm. because we're planting on a slope that slopes
right.
down to multiple water sources down there for the wildlife and for the landowner as well. So, you know, anything we can do to improve that water quality and get that infiltration as opposed to erosion from the fescue and any type
that's right.
of, you know, other issues you might have had. So, yeah, that's absolutely a key focus on this property.
And we have diversity of plants that are all native that do a lot of different things. And so big picture in simple terms, they're pulling a lot of carbon out of the air that's now going into the soil. So for all of our environmentalist friends, and I'll even say I'm a little bit like that because I definitely care about the environment. That's a
sure.
big thing, getting carbon out of the air and it's back in the soil. So that's a big start. Then you look at, let's move right up to the above the ground. You have a high diversity of plants blooming at multiple times of the year. I think that's a big requirement for this program, to where there's three species that bloom during early summer, midsummer, late summer, early fall, to where it kind of hit that
right.
window to where the monarchs, there's always something blooming. So we have lots of blooms for the pollinators. Obviously, that's the name of this blend. So pollinator species, birds, bees, everything has been at moths. Anything
right.
that's a pollinator.
Sure.
The whole insect circle,
you know,
is pollinator. So
what,
all
four,
those coming in there. Go ahead.
There's going to say there's, what, 4,000 native
yes.
Bees and wasp pollinator species in North America, in the United States. And, you know, a lot of those nest in the ground, a significant number,
yeah.
percentage of those nest in the ground. So you're not talking about just honeybees
yeah.
or just bumblebees out there pollinating. You're talking, there's a laundry list of pollinator species.
A lot of solitary bees.
Yeah.
And I think I saw something the other day that, I follow a bunch of different groups on Facebook, but one of them was about pollinators, and it said the 4,000 species,
mm-hmm.
but it said honeybees are colonized across the globe. And
right.
so it was like they're probably going to be just fine when you compare it to the native species that are really specific to certain
right.
areas of the country. And they really need this high diversity of native pollinators. So all these insects brought in help pollinate, cross-pollinate all these right here, and then including gardens and fruit trees and
sure.
Crop fields around here.
We've got some persimmons here on the property.
Persimmons.
I know there's an orchard with some peaches and some other fruit and soft mass trees in very close proximity to the property. So
yep.
Absolutely.
And so not only is these are benefiting, but the neighborhood is benefiting. Because of the increase in insects, now we have more food for northern bobwhite quail, turkeys, but all the other songbirds that aren't even on our list of game to hunt.
Right.
And so they're all benefited. So now they have increase in food, but because of the structure of the bunch grass that we're planting or that you guys are planting and the growth of the flowers, they now have cover, better structure for them. And then you lead that into, now there's great cover and structure for mice, cottontail rabbits, rats.
Tons of rodents,
right.
which now are bringing in more prey species for our native predators, like the coyote and the bobcat, which were here long before us, and they're always going to be here. So,
right.
But when we look at management, we could think about trapping. But another way to look at it is increasing the amount of prey species that are here to where there's kind of a buffer prey to where they're not chasing the white-tailed deer nearly as much, but which is the way nature had it designed. Those small prey species reproduce at rapid rates where there should be tons and tons of them to where predator species have plenty to eat.
Right. Well, yeah. And you look at a predator too. Predators are opportunistic, right? They're not holding out for a fawn.
Yeah, they're not waiting for that.
Craving
a medium rare steak.
Exactly. They're not picking and choosing what they're going to eat. They're going to find a meal and they're going to go after it. So, yeah, if a fawn is easy to find or a buck or a doe is easy to find, they're going to take it down. You know, if they can find some poults or some full grown mature turkeys, they're going to take them down if they can. But when you sprinkle all kinds of small mammals all across the landscape, they're going to find those a lot easier, a lot faster, and they're going to have a meal, and they're going to be less inclined to chase down. It takes a lot of calories and a lot of energy for a coyote to chase down a deer.
And they don't typically, even when they're going after deer, they're not chasing the healthiest buck in the woods.
Right.
They're usually targeting the wounded or the weak, and that's just how they work. And so, that's what you look at long term. That's really how a population withstands a healthy herd, is the weak or the sick are removed.
I'm going to tie into that real quick. The key to that, Justin, was the cover aspect that you're sharing. They're easiest to find. Well, what we're doing is adding cover to the landscape, and that cover is directly related to the reproduction rates of all these buffer prey, and they have a place to hide. In addition to adding all these other rodents and rabbits and everything, you know. These critters that everyone is, you know, talking about, white-tailed deer, fawns, turkeys, poults, quail, everything that people want to be more prolific, now they have a opportunity to hide where, again, this was just fescue or unmanaged timber, no succession. We're offering all these things. And, again, this is with one planting.
Yeah.
There's your list of benefits. Hopefully we covered a majority of them. There's probably a few that we're forgetting.
Yeah, you know, and one specifically I can tell you is too, when you're talking about insects, you're not talking about just pollinator species where they're going to come in and they're going to, you know, use up the pollen and they're going to, you know, pollinate. That's what they do. But you're also talking about in the off season when things aren't in bloom, the actual stems of these species become homes for the insects. The flowers themselves become homes for these insects. And that then becomes food for these game birds and for these other songbirds and anything else out there. So it's not like these are just coming in when something's in bloom and then disappear in the off season when nothing's blooming. That they actually live inside the plants themselves. So, it is beneficial year round in a mix like this. And when you plant this kind of diversity in your species, you're going to get the year round bedding and cover, and you're going to get food source.
I don't quote me on this, but I believe it's with turkey poults, the first like 6 weeks of life, I want to say it's about 70% of their diet is insect based. Yeah. And same thing with quail.
During the summer months.
I mean, it's incredible the dependency of insects for the reproduction and getting them to an age where they can fly and run and hide away from predators. But if they have all that cover and insects, food resources in areas like this, their survival rate's going to be much higher.
That's right.
And you can walk through a fescue field. You're not going to kick up a lot of grasshoppers and bugs. There's nothing out there. It's very sparse. And that just can't sustain a population of game birds and much else, really.
Well, and I think anybody who's ever planted, let's just say because of guys of some sort, at some point that planted food plots, probably planted a milo or a millet or a sedan grass or something like that, or a soybean field. And, you know, in the winter or fall, you kind of walk out there and you see this, like, flush of birds. And you're like, oh, man, you see all the birds? Like, this is stuff that happens on these pollinator sites a lot, even during the summer months where you're like, man, it's just like there's a lot of life around here. There's a lot of creatures using this. And this is something that could happen year-round in a bigger area than just your strip of milo.
And we're talking about bugging. As we're looking out the window, we're seeing – we talked about fescue and pastures, and then you look at what's incorporated in there that's going to bloom and bring in insects and pollinators into a pasture-based system. It's pretty much clover, and it's going to bloom spring, and if it's mowed and maintained, it'll bloom a couple other times throughout the year. But we just compare that to the mixture that's being planted right now, it is multiple species, spring, summer, fall, all blooming. And so you have a consistent base of those insects. It's not just like one peak. It's very spread out. So it's a consistent resource for these game animals to thrive in.
And how excited for, you know, Matt Miles, being a wildlife photographer, to be able to walk out his door and take pictures at any time of, you
That's
know, species
right.
out running around in his backyard, front yard, whatever we're calling this
yeah.
area.
Yeah. And to me, we're close to the boundary, I think, right here. But you look out one side of our window and you see 6-inch tall fescue that's been mowed probably multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look out the other side and we have a field that's being planted in this pollinator native grass blend that you're like, man, the neighbors are probably like, what in the world is he planting over there? It looks weird. And I mean, it's literally the difference between looking at a desert to wildlife to an oasis.
And I just want to, you know, paint the picture real quick for the listener that as we sit in the truck huddled up, you know, not together, but huddled up in the warmth.
Huddle
we
is a
look,
little bit more manly than cuddle.
Okay.
It is.
As we look out the window and watch the tractor and the drill go by, pass after pass, I'm sure they're trying to figure out what we're doing, but it is. It was about 30 degrees when we got started. I think it's warmed up to 32, and about 20 mile an hour winds up here on this hill. So it's pretty chilly out. And you know, as you mentioned in the opening, that you know, what are we doing out here planting in this time of year? January and February are the ideal months to be planting in the Midwest to plant your native species. Native species get planted typically anytime after November 15th through. You can even get in through May with your warm season grasses and some other things. We've had success planting that late. Typically, it stops around middle of March or end of March, depending on conditions. But, you know, you don't see that. You're right. The neighbor is confused going, what are they planting over there? It's not planting season.
That's right.
You know, your soybeans, your corn, your typical cash crops and your flowers that you buy from the big box store and you want to put in the ground, they don't go in this time of year. So, we are confusing some people out here, but this is, if you're out there, you're listening, and you want to get something in the ground, now's the time to do it.
Did we mention aesthetics?
No, and that was a point I wanted to make like how many guys have a driveway. If you live on a piece of property, you have a driveway, and you're like, man, my wife, I'd like to plant. I'd like to do something, but I don't want the deer to be right up here next to the road. So you may just like, I'll just keep it mowed, and there's not really anything I can put out there. Or I haven't really considered anything to benefit the wildlife. Pollinator blend is one of those things that, like, your wife will love it.
Oh, my gosh.
Your kids will love it.
Maintenance-free, pretty much. It's, like, basically,
once you get established,
today, yeah,
and they're going to do a couple of mowings, and I want to discuss the planting techniques in a little bit. But outside of the initial prep, and then the first year maintenance, there's some kind of preventative maintenance for invasives down the road. But it's kind of one of those where you have this high diverse wildflower mix, pollinator mix that you could have signed up for a government program depending on kind of your area. But now you have something that is incredibly beneficial to the land, but also amazing to look at. It's hard if you're looking for something that's aesthetically pleasing, like top of the list of aesthetics versus top of the list in wildlife benefit.
Useful acres.
You'd be hard-pressed to find something more beneficial.
Absolutely. You know, we do get a lot of customers that call us and say, you know, we want to be planting this alongside the road or alongside the driveway or near the house. It's going to be seen. So, and being the custom seed shop that we are, we can custom make a mix so you get a low profile but still a very showy mix. So you're still going to get all those wildflowers to bloom, but you're not going to get 6 and 7 foot tall stuff growing that's going to block a view or that's going to screen something out. And we have those species. There are several species of native wildflowers even that grow 6, 7, 8 feet tall. Mm-hmm. So we can create that screening with wildflowers. But on this particular property, Matt's going to be – he's going to have a driveway that's probably maybe close to a quarter mile when it's all said and done. Now, he hasn't built the house yet here. The driveway's not in. So we're installing this prairie, and he's going to pull in and drive right through the middle of this prairie to get to his house. And so he's going to have wildflowers and this entire mix that's going to surround him as you drive down and get to the house.
this driveway we're sitting on right now, is this a like secondary driveway that he'll be able to use too?
Yeah, this is secondary, and I think this is just more of the access to the property line. He's got some when they come in to build a home, they're going to bring all the heavy equipment and everything through this side.
You know, I hope that people are like, okay, all right, that sounds awesome. Those mixtures, there's nothing wrong with them. I've got the perfect site for that. I've always been wondering what to do with that kind of either odd area. I want to get my wife a gift for this coming year, get her out on the property more. Whatever it is, let's walk through the process here that Matt's gone through to get this site prepped and ready, and then what that next few years are going to look like for him.
Sure. Now, Matt has, just to give a little history on the property, he's owned this, I believe, for 10 years now, and hasn't really done anything. He's not a cattleman, so he doesn't have cattle out here. We talked about, the fescue and what it was doing out here, and I think this has just basically been an old field that's been mowed, and that's essentially it. But for preparation for this, again, being in the profession of outdoor photography, Matt wanted to take a few extra steps to make sure that this site was prepped really well before planting, and I'll say he's done an excellent job at that. But he probably took a few more steps than was absolutely necessary too. Mm-hmm. So
he went the extra mile.
Yeah, he did go the extra mile, but not every person that wants to plant something like this has to go this far. But specifically, he put in three different sprays to kill off all the fescue and all the species out here.
Of glyphosate.
Yes, of glyphosate from, I believe he started in the summer in July. He got the first kill on and then came back in, I want to say maybe October, and did it again. Now, on a site visit about 4 weeks ago, we were out here and he still had a little bit of green, but it was very, very well done. And we were pretty excited about it. I told him everything looked great. He had actually burned it as well. So he had two sprays and a burn when we were on the site. And it was excellent. I mean, it's a lot better to put in that work early and get that in there so that you establish the right foundation. I kind of equate it to painting, right? If you're going to paint your house or paint anything, really, you got to do a lot of taping before you're really ready to paint. And if you don't do that, then you're going to have mistakes, you're going to have errors, and it's harder to fix that after the fact than it is before.
Yeah.
Get your sprays in, get whatever you need to do. If you don't like sprays and you got a big enough tarp and you're covering, a big garden area, put a tarp on it and kill the grass that way. Do whatever you need to do to kill out that fescue so there's no competition. And then come in, and what we've done is come out and run the drill through here and plant. It's really that simple. You come in and, kill off the competition, eliminate that competition. Matt has done the burn, so that's added a little bit of, this 6-inch tall fescue. We could have drilled right through it, no problem, but he wanted that extra soil, seed-to-soil contact just in case, so he went ahead and burned off that extra duff. If there was 2-foot tall fescue out here, yeah, it needs to be mowed down or it needs to be burned off for sure. But if you've got 10 inches or less, most no-till drills are going to go right through that, no problem,
yeah.
Especially if it's already been killed off. So, come through with a couple sprays, kill it off, and you're ready to plant. Now you can broadcast or you can drill it in. In this case, we went ahead and brought the drill out and made sure we got good seed-to-soil contact. Conditions are right where the ground is. There's a little bit of moisture out here, but we're in pretty good shape. Take a quick little pause as we look out as the tractor comes over close to the truck.
Yeah.
and then as far as maintenance to really help these species get along and get established, there's a couple key factors with planting natives like this. Native forbs and wildflowers take a while to mature. And by a while, I mean a few years to fully mature to that right stage. So the first year, they're really establishing a deep root system, and that's going to be 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 foot deep. By year two, you're going to start seeing blooms, and you're going to think, oh, okay, we made some progress, but those roots are still being developed. By year three, those roots are finished. You're going to really see a lot of above ground growth, blooms. A lot of things are going to really go well year three. In that time period, you need to maintain that field so that you're not getting annuals or any undesirable weed species to come in and take over, because annuals obviously grow faster, grow mm-hmm. quicker, and they can really take over while something is taking a lot of time to mature. So you want to get in there and do a couple of mowings a year. So you don't want anything growing over 2 foot tall, really. You want to kind of keep that down to 8-10 inches or so, So you do that a few times a year, and then by year three, you're really done. You can mow it once a year if you like. You can start burning it year four, five, and you're set.
That easy. All that benefit and that easy.
Yeah, I mean,
because when we look at other, you know, types of habitat work that we can do, you know, the follow-up work, the additional herbicide, all that stuff with other projects, and you compare that to a food plot where you're planting multiple times a year, adding lime fertilizer to the soil, you don't have to do that here with the planting the native. So,
well, I think
it's huge.
That's a good point because
thank you.
Very rarely do I get to make that statement too.
I'll take it when I get it. My gosh, take no love.
When you look at a food plot, let's just say you're planting soybeans and you're trying to establish a good stand of soybeans on an acre. You need to do the soil test. You need to lime it and fertilize it, and then buy the seed, and then you have the herbicide involved. And I think in Dr. Craig Harper's book, it's like he averages out to like $300 an acre.
$350 an acre.
Let's look at native grass prep. You have the herbicide involved, of course, your time and stuff. But some of these blends that we worked with you guys to develop some blends, it was like $150 per for a bag that's supposed to be per acre.
Yeah, for that edge feather blend.
Yeah.
Oh, that's phenomenal too.
And one, I mean, that's a one-time seed cost. Plant it, and then you've got a little bit of mowing to try and keep some stuff at bay. But for the most part, it's plant it, and then the occasional fire to keep kind of things in check. But that's it. And so the initial sticker price is what I think a lot of people is like, ooh, natives, nah, no thanks.
Compare that to time and other resources going into food plots over 2 years. It's way cheaper to do this.
Yep.
And it lasts like 20-plus years.
Absolutely.
Easy. Yeah. If you continue to manage it appropriately,
and
it's so much easier.
You know, we often get the question from different landowners, especially in the you know, hunting world, because you're so used to fertilizing your food plots, right?
We get
asked a question about fertilizing all the time. You don't want to fertilize native species when they go in the ground because they can't utilize that fertilizer right away, like annuals and other weed species and undesirable species that can. You're going to actually hurt yourself if you try and fertilize it. So, no, don't spend any money on fertilizer. Plant the natives and let them, you know, take hold like they're supposed to, and just keep the annuals and undesired knocked down or knocked out. And if you got to come in and spot spray, you know, do that too. You know, you just basically got to keep an eye on it, maintain it for a few years so that as those natives grow up and take over and can now outcompete the undesirable and the, you know, all the other annual species out there that you don't want, now you've got your stand established, and it's just, you know, let Mother Nature do its thing.
Yeah,
absolutely. And that's the other thing that, you know, what's cool about natives is they're native. Like, these are the site conditions.
No kidding.
Right? But it's super simple, though. But these are the site conditions that they're used to growing in. It's not like you have to add all this additional encouragement to get them ready to grow properly. Like, you plant it, and not that you walk away, but you plant it, and they're adapted to these conditions and to these soil types. And, of course, mixtures and stuff like that, you know, working with Pure Air, let's say you live in the South, they can tailor that seed mixture to your site-specific region, climate region, soil types, everything, to make it the most beneficial, most productive for your region.
Well, yeah. And I'm glad you said that because I was recently having this conversation.
I love this podcast.
yeah, me too.
I loved it, you know, at the beginning when he sat in the back and didn't say anything.
Yeah, almost forgot he was back there. Yeah.
I ain't going anywhere, guys.
No, you know, not only site-specific, but, for example, there are a lot of species that have different varieties of that species. Let's talk switchgrass, for example. Switchgrass, right now, everybody talks about that in bedding cover for whitetails, right? It's that time of year when that's...
Keyword.
That's talked about. So switchgrass is not all switchgrass is created equal. They're all fantastic, but they're all from different regions, different areas, and they have different benefits. You know, you get your Canlo switchgrass that's going to stand up taller. It's going to be more cold, hardy, snow tolerant, so it's going to stand up full. You've got Alamo switchgrass, which is a more southern region, so it's going to be better in southern climates. You've got Nebraska 28, there's Cave and Rock, there's Blackwell, and these are all different varieties of switchgrass, right? So depending on your region or your area, we can get very site-specific and provide not only the species, but the variety of the species that benefits from your soil type.
Yes.
And that's really huge because, yeah, you can go online and you can buy something from Amazon or you can buy something from eBay, and just because it says the species you're looking for doesn't mean it's the variety or the site-specific that's been established to your ecoregion. You know, there's a lot of seeds that get bought from Oregon and from Washington State. And while those species might even be the same species, they're adapted to those climates out there. So you bring that here into the Midwest, you bring that into Missouri, and the Missouri species is supposed to bloom in June and July, but the Oregon species is blooming in May, you know, and March and April and things like that. And it throws off the pollinators because the species that they're looking for isn't blooming at the right time. So there's a lot of very site-specific things that happen behind the scenes that a lot of people don't know about. When they call us up and they say, here's our property, here's what we're looking for, here's what we want, a lot of people want a simple, quick answer, but it's not that simple or quick because you need to make sure that you're providing the right information and the right species and variety to go in their area.
And that's a great explanation of it all. And it not to scare people away from it, but from a, hey, this is a custom seed shop like you've talked about. They have the people in-house to be able to make these judgment calls and offer suggestions for the varieties to tailor make these seed blends for your property, for your area.
Right.
Let them go to work and do that and then ensure that I've got the right seed blend, seed mixture, you know, population, you know, seeds per square foot, excuse me.
Yeah.
And you're set and ready to go.
So walk me through planting technique. A lot of times it's no-till drilling, but a lot of guys that listen to our podcasts are going to be, hey, I've got to, let's say I want to improve the edge, which we talk so much about. Okay, I have a very hard, I've got 100-foot trees straight down a food plot, but I want to improve that. Maybe I'm doing some edge feathering. Hopefully so. If they've joined us for 98 podcasts or Habitat podcasts, surely by now they're considering edge feathering.
I'd hope.
I want to do some edge feathering, but I also want to improve the edge and maybe I'm planting the edge feathered blend, but I don't have a no-till drill. How can I do it?
Sure. The easiest way, what I would do is I'm going to go through and I'm going to take, a sprayer, whether it's backpack or you got an ATV side by side, whatever, spray that edge, you know, that 30 feet or that 50 feet, whatever you want to consider your edge to be, spray that out. You got to stop the competition. That's the number one thing is stopping the competition. But once you're there at that point, depending on the size, the length and the ground duff that's created after the spray. So if you've got a lot of ground duff there, you need to clear that off. That can be done prior. You can mow before you spray. So you mow it, wait a week or so till everything starts to kind of green up and grow a little bit, and then spray it. But you need a shorter length. You can't have a lot of ground duff. The key to any seed is seed to soil contact.
Correct. Yep.
So if you can create that seed to soil contact, that you're going to be successful. Now, come through and spray it out, and with a little bit of ground up there, you'll be fine. Broadcast it, whether you've got a handheld broadcast spreader or, again, ATV side-by-side tractor, whatever. Broadcast, spread that out there, and then come through with some kind of roller, cultipacker, even if you got to drive back and forth on it 40 or 50 times with your ATV or side-by-side. Just ensure that you get that seed through the duff.
Yeah.
And down to the soil, and the rest is going to take care of itself.
Should they return this spring and do, or this summer and do a mowing?
Yeah, absolutely. You'll need to come back and mow. So you're going to get, as it starts to grow, especially warm season grasses are going to, you know, you're going to see some growth with them right away. I shouldn't say right away. You'll see growth with them the first year. You'll see, you know, several feet will grow. So you want to come through and mow probably somewhere in that June, depending on how much growth you've got. It may even be later, but that first year you want to mow two or three times. Keep it around that 10-inch height. So as it grows up to 16 or 18 inches, knock it back down 8 or 10 inches. And then, you know, do that again. Give it a couple of weeks, 3, 4, 5 weeks to grow, cut it back down again. And then what that does is when you're doing that, you're continually clipping and cutting the annuals that are growing up. And keeping them from growing a seed head.
Gotcha.
And that way they can't develop a seed. They can't extend their lineage by passing on seeds into the soil. So, but you're not hurting the natives. The natives are still developing the root system. That's the important part, is developing the root. So once you knock that back down a couple times in the fall, they'll go dormant again. And then again, come the following year, you'll do it again. But they'll grow a little bit faster this time. They've got a larger root system. They're picking up a lot more stuff in the soil. So they'll grow quicker. You'll knock it down maybe two times that year, possibly three. Usually one less mowing than you did the first year.
Gotcha.
And then by year three, mow it once or twice and just let it bloom into what it is. Depending on what kind of edge blend you've got, if you want all grasses versus all forbs or any combination thereof, it's the same gotcha. Process.
Yeah. What about a guy who's already got a food plot established? Let's say there's turnips and cereal rye and oats, whatever, growing right up to the edge of the trees. Would you recommend spraying that before planting this winter, or would you let that continue to grow and then mow it in April or May?
You know what? I would let that continue to grow. Chances are you're probably, if it's growing right up to the edge of the trees, it's probably not doing all that productive compared to the rest of the plot anyway.
And that's exactly why we promote these type of perennials, to where they're going to do better right up against the edge.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what they've been doing for thousands of years. So I would just leave it and let it let that stuff die out and handle your natives and you know, plant right through it. You're not going to do you might be putting yourself through a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of work. You'll probably be putting yourself through work that's just not necessary.
Gotcha. Okay. What about broadcasting in the snow?
Excellent. I mean, as you guys have seen, native species, the seeds are incredibly small.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to, if you're using a drill, you don't want to plant any deeper than a quarter of an inch, and that's kind of pushing it. You want more like an eighth of an inch. Really, again, seed to soil contact. Think about how Mother Nature did it, right? These seeds would fall out of the bloom, the seed head, or they'd get carried off by animals or whatever, and they drop to the ground, and that's it. They didn't get planted. They didn't get pushed into the soil a half an inch or anything. So you're talking about something that basically, as long as it sets on top of the soil and gets lightly pressed into the soil, not even into it, just pressed, it's going to germinate.
Even that freezing thaw, frosting action can help.
And that's even better, especially if you're using warm season grasses, because the way that the warm season grasses are so much lighter. I mean, you guys picked up the bag of, it's like a big pillow, right?
Yeah.
So warm season grasses aren't going to settle as easily as the forbs will. So having the snow there is actually going to draw it down into the ground better. But then also the snow is putting in the nitrogen into the ground too. So you're looking at, you know, having that natural nitrogen brought out of the air from the snow and put into the ground, which grasses thrive on having that extra nitrogen. So it's even more of a benefit.
Awesome. I think, like, for us and a lot of guys, the plan is with edge feathering blend, or tall screen blend or whatever it is, and you're planting it in a food plot. So you already have established turnips or whatever. I'm going to wait for that snow to hit, broadcast on top of the snow, let it pull it down in the soil, and then we'll be ready to mow in May or what before all the turnips and everything go to seed, mow it back, and then mow it again a couple months later and kind of that'll be the step, I guess, process. Because we've sprayed for years to basically kill out the weeds, and so it's really just our food plots
food
that are
plots,
growing.
Right.
Yep.
So I sure hope all of our listeners, they have basically zero excuse to have cabin fever ever.
Yeah, because we have a long list of things for them to do. And
this is the time.
It's always habitat season, right? You can always be doing something
for sure. There's never a time to not be doing something. And we go to a lot of our properties on the consults, and they're like, you know, like, okay, kind of looking, am I going to spend a lot of money, or are they going to lay out a ton of work? Usually, we're going to lay out a ton of work.
Sure.
And so they always have something to do.
Right.
For sure.
Keep them busy.
That's right. Try to get their wives and their kids trained up on a chainsaw as well.
So, that's right. Start them early.
That's right. Yep,
for sure. And you get the wife on your side and the kids on your side. It's more reason to go buy some more toys, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Hey, need time for a new saw.
I get a smaller saw, so that way the wife's back's not hurting too much. Yeah.
Get some new bars and some new chains. It's a good time.
What is the is there any other things? We're coming up 15 minutes left, and I've got a whole lot of surprises for you guys that I've been thinking about this whole podcast. But is there anything else about planting techniques and things that people should be aware of that may come to a shock to them, like when they're in it?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we like to do is we will also use a carrier with our seed mixes mm-hmm. for the drills or for even for broadcasting. And by carrier, I mean something that you can mix in with the seed so that the seed can be distributed evenly. There's a lot of different seed sizes, especially when you get into warm season grasses. So you want something that can do that. We use, and there's a lot of different things you can use. You can use coconut husk. We use rice hulls. And what they'll do is they're slightly cupped, but it'll carry seed. And in no-till drills, typically no-till drills want to run at something closer to 10 pounds an acre, right? Regardless of your seed mix, even if you're only supposed to put out 4 pounds an acre, they want to run and operate at 10 pounds an acre, 10 pounds in there. So they just need a higher density mixture in there. So we will oftentimes use something like rice hulls to bulk up that density in the drill so that it runs smoothly. So if you're thinking about doing some kind of broadcasting or even a drill, consider contacting us or talking to somebody about adding a carrier to it. Rice hulls are incredibly cheap. There's a lot of carriers that are really cheap. You know, I know some guys have done this in the past, and we don't necessarily recommend it, but it can work, is mixing a little bit of sand or some folks have used kitty litter and some other different things like that. A lot of times running some of that coarse material through the drills isn't, great on the drills. It wears them out.
What about lime?
Quicker.
I mean, I know we're not looking at – I'm just trying to think of something that's quick and easy to get to.
If you had extra,
do you see people use like pelletized lime mixed in?
We haven't a whole lot, only because typically with natives, you're not worried about buying and putting lime out,
yeah.
right? So
yeah.
But again, it's an extra expense and pelletized lime is a lot more expensive than rice hulls. I mean, rice hulls are, a few dollars.
Well, I'm just curious because we're miles and miles and miles from the nearest rice field.
Yeah, that's true. But we do
drive to Arkansas just to get rice hulls to mix into. I don't know. There's probably hardware stores or somewhere that sells rice hulls.
I don't think you have to get all the way to Arkansas. The Boot Hill's got quite a bit of rice fields out there.
Well, Arkansas is closer.
For you guys, sure.
For us, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. That's interesting. I wondered about that.
A group of guys down in Stuttgart, they probably got a little bit extra.
Probably. They sell that stuff down there.
Oh, yeah.
I think we've come full circle to the other Justin, right?
That's right.
One or the other.
Yeah. That's right. Anything else that you can think of?
No, really, that's we kind of covered the main stuff. And the rice hulls are adding a carrier to bulk up your mix is really – We even in broadcasting, whether you've got a Vicon tractor, 3-point spreader, or you've got a hand spreader, if you bulk up that density, even when broadcasting, you can see the rice hulls and you can see, so you know that you've covered this area. Sometimes it's difficult to see with the drill. You can see the lines and you can see where you've been, but if you're broadcasting, you can't see that. Rice hulls are a little bit bigger. They're shaped sort of like a kidney bean. And so you'll be able to see the area that you're covering a lot easier. And also, if you're broadcasting, don't do it when it's a windy day out. These seeds will blow away, and you'll end up seeding somebody else's property much further away than what you wanted to. So make sure you have ideal conditions so you don't lose your seed.
That's a totally different way of looking at it. I mean, I have that hat that says we all live downstream, and usually you see somebody planting an invasive, and he's like, "Ah," and it's taking his birds are carrying the seed to the neighbor. This is where you're planting the neighbor's pasture, or your neighbor's field with a very, very fine and awesome seed.
Right.
I guess that's paying it forward.
You're welcome, neighbor.
Yep.
You're welcome.
Paying it forward.
And unfortunately, if you got that neighbor who starts to see the stuff grow up, but it doesn't have a bloom on it yet, it'd just get cut, sprayed, and
there's a
tilled
weed
or
in my pasture.
Yeah, exactly. That's what'll happen.
What's this thing with this purple bloom and there's all these butterflies floating? Better spray it.
Right.
Yep.
Cattle don't eat that. I'm gonna spray it out.
Yeah. So what's it like working in a company or an industry that is? I mean, you're dealing with deer hunters. You're dealing with prairie enthusiasts. You're dealing with probably a lot of some anti-hunters.
Sure.
That are more like garden and butterfly minded. And what is it like? I mean, you touch so many different people. I'm sure it's a thrill to be in this sort of in this business.
It's exciting. There's a lot of really passionate people out there. So you can get into these very long, drawn-out conversations with folks that want to talk about species and what they've discovered on their property and what they what they're trying to do. And what it all boils down to is everybody's passionate about their land, regardless of their use, whether they're hunting or they just, you know, they just want to see species, but they're anti-hunters, or, you know, the cattlemen and the ranchers and the livestock guys. I mean, there's so many different ways to benefit from having these species out there that I get to talk to those people, and everybody's passionate about it. So they may have different reasons for it and different purposes, but it's definitely exciting because you're always talking to these different folks. And one of the best parts about my job too is being able to help people make improvements on their land. I mean, you guys know it as well as I do that when you have the ability to go out and do something on your land, most people are excited to do it. They're not just doing it because you know, they have to, or you know, somebody told me, you know, they're
the government's
not reluctant.
Making me plant
right.
This.
They're not doing it reluctantly, right? They're excited about what they're doing and they want to do it as best they can. And so I get to talk to those people and have those conversations every day.
Yeah.
Definitely.
For sure. Yeah.
Not to jump the gun, but just as a quick little segue, someone who does want to ask you questions, how do they get in touch with you?
Well, they can email me. That's probably the easiest way, as I'm traveling a lot, as you guys know. Mm-hmm. My email address is justin@pureairnatives.com. That's pretty easy to remember since we talked about the many Justins out there, right?
That's
Justin@pureairnatives.com. You can try at the office too. Our office is 636-357-6433. Ask for me, but it is trade show season and I will be on the road a lot.
Where can they see you?
Oh, let's see. This week we're going to be at the Great Plains Growers Conference. Next week we'll be at the Western. The week after that we'll be at Illinois Parks and Rec. The following week is MNRC, then NWTF.
And NWTF, we're actually going to be there.
Yeah,
and
that's what I hear.
Right here.
Everybody,
air.
Yeah, we'll be with you guys.
What's that booth number? Do you remember off the top of your head?
I believe it is booth number 2223.
Okay.
I hope.
And it's over in the – it's probably on the side where there's a lot of – I think you said you're by NRCS. Yeah, so it's kind of over in the area where there's a lot of information to gain over in there. So
yeah, we're gonna be side by side with the NRCS folks, and they do a great job of providing a lot of information to people, and you know, those guys are the ones that help put together programs and seed plans and forestry plans and things like that for landowners. So, you know, it's going to be great for us to have a conversation with somebody and say, take four steps to your left and talk to those guys about the programs, you know, you're right here. So
absolutely.
And I believe you guys will be joining us as well.
That's right. And we'll have hopefully some hats in stock too. So
yeah, it'll be a good time.
Yeah, for sure. I'm looking forward to it. All right. So let's ask some questions here. Natives. What's your, out of all the stuff, different things, do you have a favorite native grass?
Favorite native grass? I do. And it's little blue stem. And I think it's because you get the bunch grass, right, which is beneficial to a lot of species that live on the ground, you know, mammals and birds, ground nesting birds. But I love rabbits, and rabbits really enjoy having habitat that they can get through. That you know, you start to get into the species that have the single stem, you know, your big blue stem, your switchgrass, all those are great for a lot of species. But if it becomes too thick, rabbits don't want to get, they can't get through it as easy. So, and little blue is beneficial in a lot of other ways too. Not just for rabbits and ground nesting birds. You know, I enjoy the lower profile. I'm not sure why, being 6'5", I can pretty much see over a lot of species, but
sorry,
the little
Justin,
blue,
you're not hiding in little blue.
Right. That I enjoy being able to look out over an area and see little blue. And, so I think that's probably my favorite name.
Matt, you got one?
Honestly, I'm a big fan of the Indian grass. I think height wise, it's awesome. I love the seed head. And then that orange rusty tone to it that it gets during the fall time. Beautiful.
I got to go with little blue as well, just because of the wide range it has. And then also just the fact that it's kind of that, it's pretty, you see it in a lot of places occurring native, naturally. But it, once again, it kind of that quail hunt in the little blue. You wade through much Indian grass and big blue stem. That kind of, That's annoying after a while.
You know, I feel like it's almost the underdog of the native grasses.
It is.
It's not only is it in the name, you know, little blue stem and the underdog, but it's right up there with all the other native grasses, but it just gets overlooked.
Because it's not tall enough. Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure. Native, what's your favorite native, like, wildflower?
New England aster.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That is a good one.
There's something about that. There's a lot of blooms per plant, per species. Mm-hmm. It's on the USDA Monarch-approved species list, so it's a very good pollinator for a lot of different things. And in Missouri, we have a lot of yellow wildflowers. There's a lot.
Yeah.
This is not yellow, but it incorporates a little bit of yellow. So it's the purple bloom, and it's got a yellow center in it, and there's a lot of them per species. Per plant, there's a whole lot of blooms per plant. So I really... it's a little bit taller, too. You get up into that 4-foot range or so, maybe even a little bit taller in some areas. So, it's a nice showy species, and it's tall and provides a lot of benefit.
Matt, you got one?
I'm going plain Jane and generic. But
of course. He's very vanilla.
I am. Goldenrod. I love the yellow in the fall.
Which one?
That's what I said. I'm just going plain Jane because there's a bunch. I love that one. Again, the height. And then that beautiful yellow color during the fall time. I can't beat it.
It's really tough for me. I have a hard time. Purple Prairie
I could
Clover.
Tell. You're just...
Yeah, I love New England Aster. And then, of course, I love... I'm going to go with one. I like milkweed. Yeah. No, I have a really hard time ever saying, kind of narrowing it down. I love Indian paintbrush. I think that one is just absolutely beautiful. So I'll just list off a couple right there and say those are the mine. Do you have one that's like not really considered a wildflower that is in the Forb family? It's just a Forb.
Well, I tell you one that doesn't get a whole lot of play in the flower side of things. It's not a showy species as much as others. Is partridge pea.
Yeah.
I love the fact that it's something you're going to find in more of a savanna and more, you're going to find it in a woody area. It's not necessarily, you can certainly find it out in the middle of the field growing. It does do that too. But I think that's the unpredictable nature of the partridge pea. And because it's such a beneficial species for wildlife, it's got a couple of little yellow flowers on it. It blooms, it looks, but it's not tall. You're not going to get a 6-foot or 4-foot tall, it's going to be kind of hidden in the ground. And so, I would say partridge pea is kind of my.
Another cool.
I think
flower.
Off the,
it's yeah. In that same range, height wise, is sensitive briar.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That very like spherical, purple.
Yep. Sensitive briar is cool. I think one of my favorite, the one I was asking, Illinois Bundleflower. That's been a big thing. So it can get kind of tall. It provides a ton of seed. It's got a really cool seed pod. Mm-hmm. And you kind of see that in those kind of road ditches and little bit disturbed sites, and extremely beneficial to quail and other birds. So that's my go-to.
And you make a point there too. If you want to create a stand of warm season grasses for bedding and for cover, throw in a couple of Forbs like an Illinois Bundleflower and some other things, because that's a browse species for wildlife. I mean, that's going to be something that's going to benefit from being out there. Not only is it going to help the grass species in your grass stand, but also on the reverse side, they're going to be able to feed off of that. The Forb is actually going to benefit from being out there too. So it's a good partnership, and it provides a little bit of that browse as the deer's literally in its bedroom or bedding
exactly.
area. So.
And it's not that like they're going to search out Illinois Bundleflower like a food plot. Like
right.
I think a lot of guys, why would I want food in my bedding area? I don't want them. I want them coming out and going to my food plot. Well, they're not. They're still going to do that, but you're just supplementing.
Right, and if anything, you're getting them up earlier in the day, so they're gonna get up and start moving a little bit earlier because they got food right next to them, and they're gonna browse. So they're gonna spend an extra 30 seconds moving through there.
Yeah,
eating and chewing on a couple of things. That 30 seconds. When you're drawing back on your bow and you're trying to hold it, that 30 seconds could mean everything. It could mean, the extra time you needed for that, buck to turn broadside or whatever it is. So, anything you can do to keep that deer on your property longer.
That's right. And and another thing about that is it's just more food that could be still available during those stressful times, late winter, early spring. It could be something where because they're eating those Illinois bundleflower, they're not eating your food plot in the dirt, or they're not eating woody browse somewhere else to where that's still available for months later. So, man, you can't go wrong with planting native diversity.
Right.
We sure don't think so.
No. And, I mean, nature doesn't think so either.
Nope.
So,
they've been doing a pretty good job of it for a long time.
That's the end-all judge, too, right there.
That's right. I don't really have any more final thoughts. Justin, you got anything else you want to add?
No, you know, I think it's been a great day. I appreciate you guys coming out and meeting with us so we can have a little bit of fun and see how this stuff's done, right?
Absolutely.
That's right.
See how it's made.
I mean, you think about driving down the road. Obviously, everything's pretty dormant right now, but how many patches of native plants and diversity do we drive by getting here? I can think of zero that I noticed, which is
regrettably
sad.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
very little.
Any number we would have said over one or two would have been, you know, a lie.
Yeah,
I mean,
for sure.
there may have been something out there. It was dark for some of the drive coming out this morning, but there's certainly not enough.
And the other thing, too, probably the most diversity in native plants that we saw were in the road ditches.
Oh, yeah.
Road ditches or medium.
Plenty of sunlight that is a fescue field or cropland.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're not running your cattle through the ditches on the side of the road. And, you know, nobody's hunting them. There are some road hunters and some ditch hunters.
Be hesitant on that.
But they're not planting that.
And one thing when people like, well, why are the cows, like, why aren't you great? One thing about the natives is there's a lot of time of the year where they would select out the native species before they would eat fescue grass. Especially if you watch a cow go into a stand that's got some native plants, some native weeds and grasses, they're going to eat those quicker than they would the fescue grass.
Right.
So, I think it was great. And I always enjoy seeing the conservation work you guys are doing. And thanks for coming on the podcast once again. And hopefully everybody enjoyed it. Once again, they can contact you at Justin at
PureAirNatives.com.
Yes, and then what's the website? PureAirNatives.com?
Yes, it
is.
There
you go.
And mention Land and Legacy. You guys will get a discount as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you guys, if you're listening to the podcast and you need something, give us a call, send me an email, and we'll get things rolling, and you'll get a discount with mentioning Land and Legacy. So nice little opportunity for you there. And I believe we will be talking again at NWTF.
That's right. All right, guys. We'll catch you next time.
See ya.